From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The media were willing accomplices in the coup against Hugo Chavez.
The coup in Venezuela is reversed. President Hugo Chavez is back in office. In the occupied territories, Palestinian medics begin searching for bodies in the Jenin refugee camp. Inside Yasser Arafat's compound, activists protest General Colin Powell's visit to the besieged Palestinian leader. We'll hear from an Israeli activist who threw herself out of a first-floor window of the compound to get her message across. Then protests in solidarity with those in the occupied territories around the United States. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. Secretary of State General Colin Powell met Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat in his besieged compound in Ramallah Sunday. A senior advisor to Arafat said the Palestinians pledged to curb violence against Israelis, but only if Israel ends its invasion of the West Bank. Powell then asked Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for a complete pullback. Sharon responded with a proposal for a U.S.-led international peace conference between Israel and Arab states without Arafat. The Bush administration had demanded Arafat issue a public statement denouncing suicide bombings before any meeting with Powell. Arafat complied on Saturday when he condemned both state and individual terrorism. He said, quote, "We strongly condemn all the attacks targeting civilians from both sides, and especially the attack that took place against Israeli citizens yesterday in Jerusalem. We also condemn very strongly the massacre that was committed by the Israeli occupation troops against our refugees in Jenin and against our people in Ramallah, Nablus, Tulkarm, and also the brutal aggression against the church in Bethlehem," unquote. Meanwhile, Hamas is vowing to continue suicide bombings as long as Israel continues its occupation of Palestinian territories. A spokesperson said the meeting between Arafat and General Powell, quote, "means nothing to us and raises not a glimmer of hope." Palestinian medics, accompanied by Israeli troops, began searching for bodies in Jenin refugee camp today. The development comes a day after the Israeli Supreme Court ruled the army must hand over the bodies and that the Red Cross must monitor the process. The Israeli army has refused humanitarian organizations any access to the camp, including ambulances. That is a war crime under the Geneva Conventions. Arab Knesset members petitioned the court after the army announced it would bury the bodies in unmarked graves in an Israeli cemetery, prompting a Palestinian outcry and accusations Israel's trying to cover up a massacre. Many of the refugees who've escaped also say they saw mass graves as they were fleeing. Meanwhile, in a public relations offensive, which made its way to the front page of today's New York Times, Israel's defense minister said Sunday that, quote, "dozens and not hundreds of Palestinians were killed in Jenin." Israel had previously estimated 250 Palestinians were killed. Israeli tanks swept into several more Palestinian towns and villages over the weekend. Troops poured into three villages around Jenin and imposed a curfew and warned residents to stay off the street or be shot. Israel also continued to bomb Nablus, piercing huge holes in the local government complex. In Bethlehem, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian policeman hiding in the Church of the Nativity. More than 3,000 Israelis and 30 trucks packed with emergency food, water, blankets, and medicines tried to deliver supplies to refugees trapped in Jenin on Saturday. More than 10 Israeli military tanks and armored personnel carriers and dozens of soldiers blocked the road and prevented the trucks from entering. 20,000 people took to the streets in Germany to protest Israel's invasion of Palestinian territories. In London, police say some 15,000 people marched from Hyde Park to Trafalgar Square. In Amsterdam, at least 30,000 people marched. Over 2,000 marched peacefully through the streets of a northern Bosnian town. Survivors of the Srebrenica massacre, in which Bosnian Serb troops slaughtered up to 8,000 Muslim men and boys in 1995, joined the protest. They carried banners that read, "Sarajevo and Srebrenica know what Ramallah is, and Sharon is Israel's Karadzic." Radovan Karadzic was the Bosnian Serb wartime leader and the UN War Crime Tribunal's most wanted suspect, who's indicted for genocide. In New York, thousands gathered in New York's Times Square on Friday. In Dallas, former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke at a dinner for the National Center for Policy Analysis and said peace will not be achieved until Yasser Arafat is removed from power. Hundreds of people protested outside. And finally, former resistance leader Xanana Gusmão appears certain to become East Timor's head of state as counting begin today in the presidential elections continues. The elections are the territory's final key step toward nationhood after being ruled by the Indonesian military for a quarter of a century. Democracy Now! Will be in East Timor for the May 20th ceremony of independence. When I Lose My Way, Randy Crawford here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners across the country. Well, Hugo Chavez is once again the president of Venezuela. In a stunning reversal, he was swept back into office early Sunday morning after a one-day-old military coup collapsed amidst nationwide protests. He returned to a hero's welcome, cheering crowds, waving flags, and the Venezuelan national anthem. In his first major address, he appealed for calm and vowed there would be no retaliation against those who had tried to oust him. Venezuela's military leadership took control of the government last Friday morning, arresting Chavez and installing a prominent businessman in his place. The military claimed that Chavez had resigned of his own accord, but the president's family, supporters, and government officials insisted this was not the case. Friday's military coup came on the heels of enormous anti-government protests sponsored by a coalition of military and business forces. 13 people died under circumstances that still remain murky. Eyewitnesses say a band of opposition snipers firing into a crowd of pro-Chavez demonstrators killed at least 10 of them. By contrast, coup leaders describe government troops shooting into a crowd of opposition protesters. It is this version that is most often told in U.S. newspapers. Chavez's ouster sparked mass protests throughout the country. Civilians rallied in the streets, while troops loyal to Chavez mutinied and seized control of the presidential palace. 24 hours after he took office, Carmona resigned. During his one-day presidency, however, he had dismantled the National Assembly, fired the ministers of the Supreme Court, arrested high-level members of the Chavez government, and sent others into hiding. Nations throughout the world deplored those actions and pressed for the return of democracy. Among the only countries that immediately greeted the coup was the United States. And we're going to get into this this amazing reversal this morning. First, we're going to be joined. We're joined here in the studio by William Camacaro, who's a Venezuelan activist living in the United States, who's been in hourly contact with Venezuela over the last several days, and who has numerous reports that contradict a lot of the stuff that Americans have been receiving in the corporate media here. Welcome, William.
Thank you, Juan.
Tell us first about the protest that occurred and what your sources are telling you actually did occur in Venezuela last week.
And the demonstration against the coup started in the same day that Chavez was arrested, but the media did not say anything about that.
This was Thursday?
Yes, the same day that he was arrested, Thursday at night, more than 50,000 people were meeting in the place where supposedly was Chavez arrested. And that night, Chavez was moved to a Caribbean island in Venezuela.
And in terms of this whole issue of the shooting, we have with us also by phone Gregory Wilpert, who's a former Fulbright scholar living in Venezuela, who actually participated in parts of the demonstration, and who joins us by phone. Are you there, Gregory?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
Could you tell us what you saw that day of the demonstration that we've received these conflicting accounts about here?
Yes, I got to the demonstration after the police had already started fighting with the demonstrators, and I saw actually both sides of the fight. There were several fights going on, one between the demonstrators and, the opposition demonstrators and the National Guard, and those were mostly between stones and tear gas. And in order to get into the pro-Chavez demonstration, I had to circle around and basically traverse the entire presidential palace, so I got a pretty good overview. And once I got into the pro-Chavez demonstration, I saw quite clearly that there were several different shootings going on. One from the crowd from a bridge, that is, and to a street below where there was an exchange of fire between pro-Chavez demonstrators and anti-Chavez demonstrators and police. And then also, everybody was ducking for cover from snipers who were firing at the pro-Chavez demonstrators from above, from a building above. So there were basically three main parties involved in the shooting that was going on. And
the police are controlled by who? The Venezuelan police that were shooting the pro-Chavez demonstrators who were ultimately killed. Is that right?
Yes, the police is controlled by the mayor of Venice, of Caracas, who is an anti-Chavez politician. So many people have been speculating that he was the one who ordered officials to fire into the demonstrators' crowd.
And William, what have you been told about the people who were shot?
Yes, many of them were people pro-Chavez, and many of them died with bullets on the head.
In the head?
Yes.
In other words, indicating that they might have been shot actually by snipers.
The sniper. Were sniper. And also, they were fighting. They were shooting against the palace government.
And wasn't one of the chauffeur of the vice president, was it, that was actually shot as well?
Yeah, the driver of the vice president was killed.
Of Chavez's vice president.
Yes, it's Chavez.
Gregory Wilpert, one of the things that's been mentioned is that the role of the mass media in Venezuela in all of this. Could you talk about how the mass media acted in the days leading up to the events of last weekend?
Its role has been really a shameful one here. It has been spreading all of the lies that the coup organizers have been spreading, such as, well, first of all, leading up, they have been constantly covering the opposition in great detail, in great depth, and totally ignoring anything that Chavez supporters or Chavez have been saying. As a matter of fact, before the huge demonstration against Chavez occurred, the day before they were advertising on every channel, every private channel, they were advertising about every 10 minutes for the demonstration, whereas they never covered any pro-Chavez demonstrations in the past. And then, of course, during the demonstration itself, they kept repeating the lies about how government supporters were shooting into an unarmed crowd, which, as I witnessed, just simply is not true. And then they kept on repeating the lie that Chavez had resigned, which they obviously could never prove because it simply didn't happen. There were just a whole bunch of more lies that they kept saying.
We're talking to Gregory Wilpert in Caracas. He witnessed the protests on Thursday, and joining us in the Firehouse studio here in New York is a Venezuelan activist who's been in hourly touch with the people in Venezuela, William Camacaro. So let's go through for a minute events that took place. What we're basically talking about is a military business coup. The military leadership of Venezuela, together with the business leaders of Venezuela. Would you say that is a fair description of what took place or almost took place in the attempted coup?
Yes, it's almost fair. But the thing is that the media was was playing a very important paper in what happened, because Chavez was arrested and nobody knew where Chavez was. And as
you told me over the weekend, just before he was arrested, a group of people seized control of the government owned radio station.
Yes, and the private station started to say that Chavez resigned. So and for 5 hours, more than 5 hours, they were saying Chavez resigned, but Chavez was arrested.
So no one knew exactly what had happened.
Yes, and of course, many people was confused, and the opposition took advantage of that situation.
Well, let's talk about the military before we talk about the business leaders and the fact that Hugo Chavez is head of OPEC and that Venezuela is the fourth largest oil-producing nation. It was clear the U.S. was backing this coup. If you look at the comments of people like Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, over the weekend, we're joined on the phone by Eric LeCompte, who is with School of the Americas Watch. They're mobilizing for a major protest in Washington on April 20th. Eric LeCompte, who is the military in Venezuela?
As in many countries in Latin America, the military in Venezuela, the commanders, the generals, the officers, for the most part, are all graduates of the School of the Americas. As the events unfolded in Venezuela, we were extremely concerned as this new president, Carmona, began to dismantle the parliament and void the constitution. And as we looked into that information, we found that the military backers of Carmona were indeed graduates of the SOA, including Army Commander-in-Chief Efren Vasquez, who took a course at the School of the Americas in command in 1988, and also General Ramirez Poveda. Both of these primary people behind the Carmona government were graduates of the SOA. So again, we're finding a very clear pattern in Latin America that graduates of the SOA continue to support dictatorships and tyranny through Latin America. And in fact, we found that in total, the school has produced at least 11 Latin American dictators throughout all of Latin America.
And in addition to that, William, isn't it true that William Bratton, the former police commissioner of New York City, was down in Caracas training the police of the opposition mayor last year in crime-fighting techniques?
Yes, he was there. And he has been also in Mexico and in other parts of the continent. And he was almost 1 year advising the police department, the Caracas Police Department. And that job was given to him by the mayor, the Caracas mayor, Alfredo Peña.
Who was an opponent of
yes.
Chavez. The other thing I think that is critical to understand is not just that Venezuela is a key U.S. Exporter of oil to the United States, but that in the past, before Chavez, the United States government could always depend on Venezuela to break any kind of OPEC oil policy. If OPEC reduced oil production, then Venezuela could be counted on to increase it. But ever since Chavez has come to power, he has made Venezuela a member of OPEC, and in fact, I think Venezuela is now the president of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, and has refused to increase oil production given this new cutback by Saddam Hussein in protest over the Palestinian situation. So that there was a critical issue of petroleum supplies at play here that the Bush administration needs. A Colombia that is subservient to it to be able to break any potential problems from OPEC over the current situation in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but also I think Hugo Chavez foreign policy is very for United States is very painful, because he is again the Plan Colombia. He was again the bombing in Afghanistan.
Showing pictures of dead Afghan
yes,
children.
He chose this and he has a television show, and he showed a picture of the people that were killed by the bombing, USA bombing there.
He met with Saddam Hussein.
Yes, he met with Saddam Hussein. And also, I read that in Iran and Iraq we're celebrating the Hugo Chavez comeback.
One other thing, in terms of the land reform issue, what was the law that was passed several months ago that infuriated the wealthy classes in Venezuela?
Yeah, that's very important. He passed 49 laws. One of the most important is the land law. This law controls the how do you call it, the owner of the land, established control in. In Venezuela, for example, the British crown, la corona británica,
the British crown,
has more than 200,000 acres, and they have something there for take vacation to go to fund something like that, and nobody from Venezuela come. You know, tiene la oportunidad de llegar allí.
So in other words, with the land law, he threatened to confiscate all land larger than what? How many acres?
5,000.
Larger than 5,000 acres,
yes.
That was not being used.
But the law said that you can have more than 5,000, but you have to prove to the state that you are doing something with that land. If you are not doing anything with that land, the state are going to take.
For students of Latin American history, you'll recognize the pattern. It was the land reform of Jacobo Arbenz that
Guatemala.
Brought about his downfall in Guatemala. It was the land reform of Juan Bosch that brought about his downfall in the coup in the Dominican Republic. And nothing upsets the Latin American ruling classes like a challenge to land ownership in
or
Latin
the U.S.
America.
Government. And speaking of the U.S. government, on NBC on Sunday, Condoleezza Rice, the national security advisor, said Chavez had been, quote, moving frankly in the wrong direction for quite a long time. Clearly, the administration seriously disliking Hugo Chavez. A White House statement did not welcome his return, quote, and this is from the Washington Post, quoting the statement, "The people of Venezuela have sent a clear message to President Chavez that they want both democracy and reform." What role, Gregory Wilpert, do you see the U.S. playing, or will this have to come out in the days to come, in this coup, as Latin American leaders decried the businessman who became the interim head and said that they were going to start sanctioning Venezuela?
Yes, the U.S. government is certainly involved. I mean, many people here say that the opposition is so fragmented and disorganized, they could never have organized such a smooth coup on their own. Not only that, actually, the Washington Post reported yesterday that there was a parade of opposition leaders and military into the U.S. embassy and meeting with U.S. officials, so it looks very suspicious. Of course, we don't have any, you know, hard facts about what exactly U.S. involvement has been, but the speculation is certainly there that there has been some serious involvement, especially considering, I mean, as I said, how smooth it was and how quickly the U.S. government recognized this illegal coup.
Of course, and hard evidence often comes years after these events.
Right.
But we do know the similarity between what's happened here and many other places, and we do know that Otto Reich is the U.S. Assistant Secretary for Western Hemispheric Affairs, and he is known for his ability to not only manage media coverage of Latin American issues, but he was part of the old William Casey Ali North operation that attempted to overthrow the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and was actually criticized in government reports by the GAO and others for his using of government positions to engage in propaganda and lobbying activities on behalf of the Contras in Nicaragua.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Very significant developments over this weekend. A democratically elected president of a Latin American country looks like he's being overthrown. The people rally in the streets, and he is brought back to the presidential palace, where he makes an address 4 o'clock Sunday morning to the people.
Sure.
Not saying we will attack those who try to overthrow us, but striking a very conciliatory tone, saying there must be no retaliation. retaliation, no witch hunt. He held a crucifix in one hand and a miniature copy of Venezuela's 1909 constitution in the other.
And the price of oil is expected to rise sharply today on the commodities markets.
I want to thank William Camacaro for joining us here in New York at the Firehouse Studio. Venezuelan activists Gregory Wilpert, former Fulbright scholar living in Caracas, Venezuela, was an eyewitness to the protests in Caracas on Thursday. And Eric LeCompte of School of the Americas Watch. And you can go to their website at soaw.org for more information about the protests that are building for this next weekend, April 20th, a major anti-war mobilization in Washington, D.C. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to the occupied territories.
Find pretending like a food on the van. Give a listen to their voices on the back of your mind. Sometimes my softest whisper to the loudest stare. Giggle wiggle wiggle like a wind in your sail. Provide a few for my senses, everything. Love is a good love is a reading that we see. And upon the stairs I sail from a mountain top. And the positive style we've got to rise up, rise up. And oh, well everybody gotta rise up, rise up. And oh, everybody gotta rise up, rise up. Oh, well everybody gotta rise up.
Rise up, N Train, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we head to Jenin in the northern West Bank, the occupied territories. Palestinian medics accompanied by Israeli troops began searching for bodies in Jenin refugee camp this morning as Palestinian Authority Chair Yasser Arafat conditionally accepts an Israeli proposal for a Middle East peace conference led by the United States. Palestinians charge the Israeli military has killed hundreds of people in the camp, although this weekend the Israeli military said the number of Palestinians who died was in the dozens. International humanitarian groups are still trying to establish how many people are dead, how many are still lying wounded, how many are buried beneath the rubble. Over the weekend, the stories of death and destruction continued to seep out of the Jenin refugee camp, which was once home to 15,000 Palestinians. Those who escaped describe how camp residents leapt from window to escape the advancing bulldozers, how some survived beneath the rubble and called for mobile phones, how some people were cut in half by tanks. The Israeli army continues to deny these reports, saying no atrocities have occurred, that the dead were terrorists killed in fighting. According to Jenin municipality authorities, two-thirds of the homes inside the camp have either been flattened or rendered uninhabitable. They say there are about 5,000 people still inside the camp, surrounded by tanks and snipers. Several convoys of ambulances drove through the alleys of the camp this morning, a day after the Israeli Supreme Court rejected the Israeli military's plan to bury most of the bodies from the camp in an Israeli cemetery and insisted the Red Cross monitor the gathering of the corpses. After banning reporters from the camp throughout these last days, the Israeli military escorted a group of journalists through the camp on Sunday. The official convoy of reporters saw only one body. But this morning, a group of eight international activists made their way into the camp after facing off with Israeli soldiers, and they have a different story to tell. One of them is with the group called Voices in the Wilderness, based in Chicago. He is co-coordinator Jeff Gunsell, and he speaks to us from the Jenin refugee camp. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you tell us where you are and what you see?
I'm at the edge of the camp right now. We're hemmed in by two APCs and a lot of soldiers. We were trying to help just a handful of people take a gurney loaded with food and water across a destroyed road to get to people who need it. And the soldiers have stopped us, and they're not giving us permission to pass. And then behind me, in the other direction, I saw a little push cart that somebody, I can't tell who from here, had loaded up with the same types of supplies. They were also turned back in a different direction. That's where we are now. Earlier today, we were actually walking around through the camp, standing on top of the rubble of what was once many, many, many homes, and walking over, children's toys, shoes, clothing, beds, pieces of household furniture, pieces of cars, just outrageous destruction. It was post-apocalyptic. I can't wrap my mind about what I've seen today. Upon entry to the camp, the soldiers told us they had done nothing wrong. There was nothing to see here. Come back in a couple of days when, quote, our project is finished. And I told them that what we see already is evidence of a massive war crime, and they didn't like that language. And we pushed on, and ultimately they let us go around a corner and enter the camp from a place where they were not. And that's when we walked up on top of the rubble.
And, Jeff, were you able to talk to any people that were still inside the camp or see any signs of life?
As soon as we started seeing signs of life, some cries from an old woman came from a house kind of partly buried in the rubble. And myself and a Swedish member of the team went down to that house to help carry the woman out and then to walk her to the hospital. She was terrified, rightly so, because you could hear the tanks and the APCs moving around the area. But we had to carry her down in the street and buy some of these APCs just to get her to the hospital. At one point, we had to actually take a rest because it was just the two of us carrying her. And it was very awkward. And we sat down with her in the road. We had to yell to the soldiers around us that we were an American and Swedish citizen, that we were trying to get this woman to the hospital, that we'd be gone in a few minutes. Please don't shoot. While we were sitting there, we looked up to our right and saw in a third-floor apartment building soldiers ransacking a home. They were throwing crystal out the window in our direction, not necessarily at us, I don't know, but it was further terrifying, this old woman. And they were clearly destroying the inside of the home. And we're hearing reports of gold being looted and valuables being looted and possessions being destroyed. What we're hearing and seeing is that thing that wasn't destroyed from the outside was most certainly destroyed from the inside. Well, so we told one of our members, Kathy Kelly, to go along and get a stretcher. She went to the hospital, which was just a block away, and she was running, and the soldiers started running at her with their guns pointed, and she had to convince them that we meant no harm, which we've tried to tell them many times, and that she was simply going to get a stretcher, pointed to us where we sat with the old woman. The soldiers would not help, and the hospital workers were afraid to come out because they know that people are being shot in the street. Tanks are driving around broadcasting the message, do not come out of your homes. And so Kathy ran back to us with a stretcher, we put the old woman on it, and we got on our way and got into the hospital to the doctors who were too afraid to go outside, passing, by the way, an ambulance that had been shot up the days previous, some point in the invasion.
There's a front page piece in the New York Times today, Jeff Gunsell, who, by the way, is speaking to us from Jenin, one of the few people who have gotten into the refugee camp who are not the refugees themselves, that there are... They're challenging what Palestinians are saying, hundreds dead, saying that there are dozens dead. Now, there is a numbers game here, whether it's dozens or 100. But Israeli journalists were given a tour of the camp yesterday, saw only one body, said there wasn't a massacre. Another journalist managed to escape the tour, said he saw five bodies. What about overall the numbers that we're talking about?
It's difficult to say. What we can say is there were 50,000 people in this camp, and it's estimated that now there are 2,000 to 3,000 that remain. The rest are scattered around in neighboring villages, which we've visited to interview the refugees. Some are being detained still. Others, obviously, are dead. A doctor we asked from Jenin last night, now the only doctor working with 800 refugees in Jenin City, and he's a general practitioner, and he's working overtime and not sleeping. We asked him that same question, what kind of numbers would you put this at? And he said, you know, I think this is an answer of integrity. We can't say. We don't know. We won't know. People are buried under the rubble. People are missing. People are in villages. People are in prison. It's going to be a long time before we can say what the count is. And he just repeated what he's heard. Some have said 100. Some have said dozens. Some have said over 1,000. And the sad reality is you don't know. I can tell you, walking on top of dozens and dozens of what once were homes that I can't imagine that we're talking about a dozen, and I certainly can't imagine that we're simply talking about a dozen fighters. Clearly there was resistance in this town. We know that this is an area where some of the heaviest resistance is and where the Israelis lost some of, you know, the largest numbers of their soldiers. That's clear. But what we're doing here, or what they're doing here, is not unlike what we did to Afghanistan to get after a few quote-unquote terrorists.
Jeff Gunsell is one of eight Americans inside the Jenin refugee camp. We're also joined on the phone by Muen Rabbani, director of the Palestine Field Office of the Palestinian American Research Center, which is based in Ramallah, founded a few years ago by Americans and American-based Palestinian academics to promote specialized research on Palestinian studies. What can you tell us about what is going on in Jenin right now and the picture that is being put out by the press, by the Israeli military, the government.
Well, I'll gladly refer to Jeff, seeing that he's there and I'm not. But from what we've seen, if we take, for example, only what's been reported in the Israeli media, Israel's foreign minister, Shimon Peres, approximately 4 or 5 days ago, already referred to what the military conducted in the Jenin refugee camp as a massacre. The military high command seconded that by saying, when the world finds out what happened here, all hell will break loose. Subsequently, an Israeli military spokesman spoke of hundreds of dead in the Jenin refugee camp. And since then, all of a sudden, all of this has been denied as ever having been said. And we're talking about allegedly just a few dozen heavily armed Palestinians who were killed in exchanges of fire with the Israeli army, who somehow, despite area shelling, despite demolishing numerous homes with people still inside them, despite numerous eyewitness reports of summary executions of both fighters and civilians, despite an overwhelming volume of testimonies from former residents of the camp, somehow we're told that not a single civilian, or perhaps just one or two, were killed during this atrocity. Clearly, we're talking about the largest Israeli atrocity committed against Palestinians since the Sabra and Shatila massacres in 1982. How many were killed? We don't know. It could be many dozens. It could be many hundreds. And the reason we don't know is very simple, that the Israelis have systematically prevented free access to the camp, whether by journalists, whether by human rights organizations, or whether by humanitarian relief agencies, because they are determined to conceal the truth. So my position on this is if you have the Israelis preventing access in order to have Palestinian claims verified, and the Palestinians insisting on an independent and impartial investigation of their allegations, we have to assume that the Israelis are covering a chamber of horrors up until proven otherwise.
Jeff Gunsel, have you been able to ascertain where the people who once lived in the Jenin refugee camp are now?
Where they are. I visited the village of Romani, the village of Taibe, and also Jenin City. There are 800 in Jenin City, approximately 700 in Romani, and then there are a couple hundred in Taibe, but they're also scattered in Bertin and other villages in the area, some of which have now, since the invasion of Jenin, also been occupied. So they're going through this terror a second time. So we know they're going around. What is happening, the reason a lot of these people are ending up there is that, you know, they're rounding up the young men and in some cases stripping them down to their underwear in the early days of the invasion and hog-tying them in their underwear on the ground, taking them for interrogation, and then dropping them at a petrol station on the West Bank side of the Salem checkpoint, which is basically at the Green Line. And from there, where they're dropped, blindfolded, handcuffed, and naked, essentially, villagers have been picking them up, buying them clothes, and taking them to various refugee camps. We visited that petrol station and saw hundreds of blindfolds, hundreds of clipped handcuffs ourselves, which confirmed the stories we were hearing. We're also hearing from refugees that some of the men are having the word terrorist written in Hebrew stamped on the cover of their IDs. And young men under 16 who don't have an ID are getting Polaroids taken, and they're supposed to present those as their ID if they run into the Israelis again. It has their name. It says it's processed. And so, yes, we have been going around to where those people are to try to talk to them because it was very difficult to get into Jenin.
How did you manage it, considering very few people have been able to, and most people should be aware that if you've seen any reporter on television say they made it into the camp, they are escorted by the Israeli military.
Right. Well, it's quite a story. I'll try to make it brief. We set out on the main road to Jenin, five of us, three women and two men. We were quite quick. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Okay. I'm sorry. We were quite quickly stopped. The three women sat down and refused to move, and they arrested the two men. Now, the thing is that they have to get the police to do any arresting. The army can't do it. And they have to get women to lift the other women off the ground. And so it was much easier for them to take us. They took us to the police station at the Salem checkpoint, where we saw three of these men blindfolded, cuffed, but clothed, being led around. And they interrogated us a bit. and drove us out into Israel on the other side of the checkpoint. The women, in a very strange twist, were given food, water, and sunblock and told to be careful and get on their way. So the two of us who were arrested actually snuck back around through the mountains into the West Bank and amazingly made our way back to our group where we pressed on towards Jenin. When we got to the checkpoint, it was actually a military camp, tents and soldiers everywhere. We were met by many soldiers who asked us what we were doing. We told them we were going to Jenin. We wanted to see with our very eyes what our tax money was doing to the people of Jenin camp. And that we had a responsibility, that we were not journalists, that we were unarmed. They said, no, it's very dangerous for you. We said, listen, we've considered the danger. Don't worry about us. And this went on back and forth for quite a while, and the general came out, and it went on with him. And then finally, after the general had left, we were with four or five soldiers, and the highest ranking of all of them, who we had been talking to quite a bit and who seemed to be somewhat sympathetic to what we were trying to do, I have no idea if that's true, said to us, well, listen, we can't say no to you. If you cut up 100 yards or 100 meters and go through that field and go in through the outskirts of Jenin City, we can't say no.
Jeff, are you still there? Jeff Gunsel speaking to us from Jenin, describing how he got into the refugee camp and what he has been seeing there. He's with the group's Voices in the Wilderness, a group well known for opposing the sanctions against Iraq for the past 10 years. He is with Kathy Kelly, the founder of that group. Also on the line with us, and we're alarmed that he was cut off at that point as he was telling his story, but we are joined by Moen Rabbani, who's director of the Palestine Field Office of the group Palestinian American Research Center. Can you, before we go to someone who is also in Ramallah, where you are, a woman who jumped out of one of the first floor windows of the Arafat compound to protest what the U.S.'s role is in the Israeli reinvasion of the West Bank. Moen Rabbani, can you give us a quick history of the Jenin refugee camp?
Well, the Jenin refugee camp, like most Palestinian refugee camps, was established in 1948 as a result of the forcible expulsion of approximately 90% of the Palestinian population of what became the State of Israel. With specific regard to the Jenin refugee camp, it's about 1 square kilometer, has about 15,000 residents, or I rather had about 15,000 residents, most of whom originate from villages in the Haifa district of what is now Israel. It's been really a thorn in Israel's side since the 1930s as one of the centers of Palestinian militancy, including during the first uprising between 1987 and 1993 and during this uprising. And all the indications are that the Israelis decided to choose the site in the far north of the West Bank to make an example out of it and teach all the Palestinians a lesson. And I think we're now beginning to deal with the consequences of this.
In light of the fact that the Israelis are claiming that they had about 23 dead and 150 wounded in Jenin, is it conceivable in your estimation that there were actually almost just as many Palestinian dead in this enormous assault?
Just 23 Palestinian dead. Once again, we don't know because Israelis are systematically preventing us from finding out. But all the available reports that we have suggest that Palestinian casualties are very much higher, suggest that a very significant proportion of Palestinian casualties are civilians, and suggest that a very high proportion of the Palestinian civilian casualties were deliberately killed by the invading Israeli forces. I should add that in terms of the death toll, it's not going to be very difficult to find out exactly how many people were killed. In the Sabra and Shatila massacres in 1982, it was a problem because a not insignificant proportion of the residents were Lebanese Shiites who lived in the camp and who were not under the responsibility of the United Nations agency responsible for Palestinian refugees, which supervises the Palestinian refugee camp. In the case of Jenin, the vast majority, I would say at least 95% of the camp residents, would have been somehow registered with the relevant UN agency. So it's simply a matter of comparing the UN agency's population registry for the camp and finding out how many of these people are still around. And that way we should be able to arrive at a fairly accurate casualty number for at least the civilian population of the Jenin refugee camp.
Mouen Rabbani, we are about to go to a woman who was protesting the Colin Powell visit inside the compound, a Jewish American and Israeli. But I wanted to ask you a last question. I read an obituary in the New York Times last week, a very touching obituary of a woman who was one of the last fighters in the Warsaw Ghetto resisting the Nazi when the Nazis invaded entirely. Would you make any comparisons between what happened in Jenin and the Warsaw Ghetto?
Well, it's not whether I would make a comparison or not. The comparison has, in fact, been made by a senior Israeli military officer on the eve of the invasion and occupation of Palestinian cities and refugee camps this past month. This senior Israeli officer was quoted by the Israeli newspaper Yediot Ahronot as saying that if one is going to be engaged in urban combat, one has to study the relevant cases available from history, and specifically mentioned what he termed the successful Nazi campaign to subdue the Warsaw Ghetto as something that should be studied in order for lessons to be learned. If one is not going to conclude that this is a recipe necessarily for mass extermination and genocide, the very least that can be said is that it demonstrates that a key Israeli aim with its current campaign is to seek to definitively break the will of the Palestinian population to further resist Israeli military occupation.
Mouen Rabbani, I want to thank you for being with us from the Palestine, from the organization, the Palestinian American Research Center in Ramallah. We have been breaking very late, going to our breaks late, because we're afraid of losing people on cell phones in these occupied areas. We already lost Jeff Gutzel, who was speaking to us in one of the first reports, unaccompanied by an Israeli military officer of an American inside the Jenin refugee camp. When we come back, we'll be joined by Netta Golan. She's an Israeli peace activist who's inside Yasser Arafat's compound. Stay with us.
There's been rumors of wars, wars that have been. The meaning of life has been lost in the wind. Some people are thinking that the end is close by. Instead of learning to live, they are learning to die. Let me die in my footsteps before I go down under the ground. Well, I don't know if I'm smart, but I think I can see when someone is pulling the wool over me. And if there's a war and death comes around, let me die on this earth, for I'll die underground. Let me die in my footsteps before I go down under the ground.
Let me die in my footsteps, sung by Happy Traum with backup vocal and guitar, Bob Dylan, recorded in 1963. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we go to the compound in Ramallah of Yasser Arafat. Netta Golan is there. She is an Israeli peace activist. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Netta.
Thanks, Amy.
Can you tell us about the Colin Powell Yasser Arafat meeting, and what about the protests that took place at that time?
Well, the meeting between Yasser Arafat and Colin Powell, despite the fact that the president himself described it to us as a very pleasant one, you know, a very relaxed one, I'm afraid that from my analysis, it was quite bleak, because the issue of Israeli withdrawal from the Palestinian cities, which has been demanded by Colin Powell himself and by President Bush, was not even on the agenda of the meeting. So after appearing on television and stating his friendship to Ariel Sharon, while the massacre in the Jenin camp was going on, and after postponing his visit here because of the death of six Israelis in a suicide bombing carried out by a young woman from Jenin camp whose entire family was massacred, Colin Powell came here without any offer, without any statement that the Israelis will withdraw you know, Ariel Sharon isn't willing to do that, and it's quite clear that the Americans government are not putting any pressure on him to do that, that any of the statements have until now only been lip service. So the meeting was pleasant. I mean, the president said the problem is not with Colin Powell. The problem it was Sharon. But he also made it very clear that in order to end the ongoing massacre and occupation, that there has to be strong international pressure, especially American pressure. And he stated to us examples in the past of when Americans did actively pressure Israel into withdrawing from areas, including the Sinai and Egypt, and the order was carried out within half an hour. So it's quite clear that pressure isn't being made. Colin Powell gave Ariel Sharon's request for a ceasefire from the president, and the president, you know, said that he would be willing to announce a ceasefire as soon as the Israelis withdraw from the Palestinian cities. This is not an offer that's acceptable to Ariel Sharon. He wants a unilateral ceasefire, basically, from the Israelis, while troops continue to besiege both the presidential compound, the Church of Nativity, and the Jenin camp and the old city of Nablus, not to speak of continuing the military occupation of the entire West Bank and Gaza. And like I said, the president said a ceasefire will be called as soon as they withdraw. The Secretary of Health should be meeting with Sharon tonight and coming back here tomorrow. Now, the activists that were in the building, we had put signs up outside where Powell was supposed to come in, you know, risking our life in front of the Israeli snipers, put up those signs so that our message would be heard. And we were standing outside on the steps waiting to receive Powell with our messages, you know, that the occupation is terrorism, that there's another Nakba, which is catastrophe happening in Jenin, that like the massacres of Deir Yassin and other places in 1948 and the massacres in Sabra and Shatila, there's another massacre going on in Jenin camp and in Nablus. The American security told us and the Palestinians that if we do not leave from where we were standing, Colin Powell would cancel his visit. So we walked. Excuse me.
What did you do at that point?
We entered the building and our signs were removed. I guess our signs were also a security risk as far as the American delegation was concerned. And we insisted on meeting with the press because they had a small delegation of American journalists from the White House that were allowed into the building. They were kept in a small room in the building, and we weren't supposed to be allowed to meet with them either, and I asked how that would threaten the security. We did get a chance to talk to them, but once the secretary was inside, we opened the windows and hung our signs through the windows so that they could be visible to the press that was standing outside, and I went down to one of the windows in the bottom floor, and I stepped out on the windowsill because we were being blocked upstairs by two federal agents from going downstairs. And so I went down from another way and got onto the windowsill, and two of the federal agents that were downstairs, were heavily armed, were saying to me, you know, stay where you are, don't leave the building. I asked why. They said because they can't guarantee my security if I come down, and I said, well, I don't need their guarantee, and that they haven't guaranteed my security in the last 2 weeks that I've been here. And I jumped out of the window with a sign saying making reference to the massacre in Jenin, and went towards the journalists. Then basically the federal agent said that I would either go back inside the building or they would hand me over to the Israelis. And since, I had made my point, I went back into the building. It was also very important to talk to the journalists. I don't know if what they said would have come out, but I expressed to them that, we as internationals are extremely concerned by the path in which President Bush and Ariel Sharon are leading the world into, in which every Arab civilian knows that his blood is cheap, that the killing and massacring of Arab civilians, whether they're Palestinian, Afghanis, or Iraqis, is a legitimate thing in the eyes of the West, well, the killing of Westerners is considered, you know, something that is to be avenged. And I gave the example of how Colin Powell has treated the massacre in Jenin and how he treated the killing of the six Israelis. So the,
it's interesting. Robert Fisk, the reporter for The Independent, has a piece this week, Why Doesn't Colin Powell Go to Jenin? But Neda Golan, you're an Israeli-American. What brought you to point?
I'm an Israeli-Canadian, actually.
Israeli-Canadian. What brought you to this point?
Well, I and other Israelis are a part of a minority that has had, over the years, contact with Palestinians, with the real people, you know, and have seen the situation on the ground and have not been fed by the Israeli media as to what's happening here. Most Israelis are deceived by the lies that their media perpetuates. But I've seen how you know, how living under occupation is a daily rape of the Palestinian people. You know, they're raped of their dignity, of their rights, of their lives, of their future. And I've seen how throughout the years of the peace process, the situation in the occupied territories just got worse. The land grab was on more intensely than ever. And Palestinians were saying to me and to others, you know, it's going to explode. If something doesn't happen soon, it's going to explode. So when it did explode, while other Israelis were shocked, because they were fed the illusion by their media that there was a peace process going on, I was only shocked by the Israeli response of having snipers shoot into the crowds, and the fact that the international community accepted that. I'm here because I know that the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is the moderate leader of the Palestinian people, the leader that led his people to accept a historical compromise to accept Palestinian state on 20% of historical Palestine, side by side with the state of Israel, which is an incredible compromise, and a compromise that his people were willing to accept because they love and respect their leader, and because they are a peace-loving people. And but in order to perpetuate the occupation and the Zionist dream of having a Jewish state on all of Palestine, the Israeli leadership, including Barak, have been interested in radicalizing and Talibanizing the Palestinian street. They know exactly what to do to push people to desperate measures like suicide bombings, and they know exactly what they need to do in order to stop that. When Barak wanted to get elected and he wanted things to be quiet for 2 weeks before the election, he gave talks. He gave people a little bit of hope. He opened the roads a little bit. You know, just let people breathe. You know, and the entire Palestinian population was holding their breath, you know, hoping that something good would happen. And the rest of the time, when they need excuses in order to delegitimize the Palestinians' legitimate claims for independence and for freedom, they do everything they can to push them to desperate acts like suicide bombings, because then they can justify their military campaign against them and the ongoing ethnic cleansing that's going on in Palestine.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us, Neda Golan. She's inside Yasser Arafat's compound. She is an Israeli-Canadian Jew, and we thank you for being with us. That does it for the program. If you want to email us, you can send your mail to mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner. Our engineer and music maestro is Anthony Sloan. We are broadcasting from downtown community television. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Said it don't make no difference whether you're out or whether you're in. No, the world keeps going around and around.